few minutes on one other thing. I want you to tell me what this conjures up in your mind. Just give me the words.
Oppressive.
Pardon?
Oppressive.
Oppressive.
Authoritarian.
Authoritarian?
It's influential. The Roman Catholic Church hopes it can say one thing, all of a sudden, how many millions of people, billions of people now follow.
Influential?
Very powerful. Mm-hmm.
The Pope can say one thing and...
And now
lots of people will follow you, so...
Yeah, not that it's bad, but they have so much influence over a large, large population of the world. So, powerful.
At one point it's even totalitarian, but now it's not so much.
Totalitarian. Well, that's an interesting word, you know, totalitarian. I mean, there's a sense in which, you know, this is totalitarian. What does Catholic mean? Universal. What, in this context, what does universal mean? One could say, well, let's just play with the idea a little bit. One could say the Catholic Church is universal in the sense that there's probably no country in the world where there isn't Catholics. Do you know if there is any country where there isn't Catholics? I don't think so. No, there's Catholics in Saudi Arabia. Not many, but there are some. So that's one way to think about it. But another way, and a more classical way of thinking about it, about universal, is that this is a tradition which thinks it has something to say about all aspects of life, the total aspect of life. So it's got something to say about birth, about womb children, about love, about death, something to say about suffering, something to say about health, something to say about your relationship to each other, something to say about the state and the place of the state, something to say about compassion, something to say about service. So it means universal in that sense, too. It speaks to, as our colleague here used the term, which we usually consider kind of dark term, totalitarian. But totalitarian regimes are a kind of secular and political Catholicism. That is, totalitarian regimes think they've got something to say about every aspect of your bloody life. Whether you like it or not. You know, so when you look at the Soviet Union, or when you look at Nazism, and we have other examples in the world, those are regimes which are concerned with the total aspect of life. So is Catholicism. It's a question about how they configure that. The Roman part, what do you think the Roman part means? The fact that they're both together is always a charm to me.
Imperialism.
Pardon?
Imperialism.
Imperialism. Why do you say imperialism with Roman? Because of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Catholic Church grew up really in the Roman Empire. So what are the gifts of the Roman Empire? What are the gifts of Roman culture?
A lot of things. Like Latin.
Yeah, sure. So there is a Latin language, a language that covers a lot of territory. And but that's part of the Roman culture, and it becomes a universal language. But what are some of the other gifts that Roman culture bequeathed to the modern world? There are two main ones that I think of.
Roads?
That's nice. It did that. They really knew how to build a road. We're pretty good at that in Alberta, too. It's a difficult climate to build a road in Alberta, and we do a pretty good job. Well, normally, we think of the Roman, the gifts of the of Roman culture to the modern world as being two, law and bureaucracy. Law and clear administrative authority. So the Roman Catholic Church has as an intimate part of its way of functioning both this concern for the universal, that is concern for all aspects of human life and the human being's relationship to the life of the world and to the presence of the divine. But it also has this way of organizing that, of seeking to organize that through a legal structure. You don't have to leave, you know, just because I'm talking about Catholicism.
No, I'm not. I'm here. So I can see it.
Oh, okay. He's vulnerable to converting to Catholicism, so he may have his come to the Pope moment here. So one of its gifts is to give legal structure to all aspects of life. So something like the Code of Canon Law in the church is a pretty regular port of call for the Roman Catholic Church. And then the other part of it is this part that I've called the bureau. The bureau. The bureaucracy. So how does that function just for a moment in Catholicism? You have a central authority. How many know what this word means? How many could translate this word into the vernacular? No. How many could translate it into Greek?
Papa,
you got into this class without knowing your
Greek. Is it Papa or something like father?
Look at that. Papa. Papa. El Papa. I mean, it's what my children used to call me before they decided to behead me. Which is what happens when you're a father at times. So it's a common word for father. The Pope of Rome has many titles. He's the Bishop of Rome. He's the servant of the servants of God. He's got all these different kinds of titles that have accrued through time. And then under the Pope, you have what's usually called the College of Cardinals. What would be the equivalent in the government of Alberta? You have a man sitting in this room that sat on that line at one point in the equivalent of, well, damn close to Stoli.
Another line down.
I'm related
to somebody. No. Try again.
Oil companies.
Pardon?
Oil companies.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the government of Alberta and the Roman Catholic Church function quite similarly around oil. It's just that the Roman Catholic Church is crude oil and it's olive oil. Sometimes called the oil of gladness. So, what do you think this is? Right underneath the Pope. You know, we're talking about this structure. It's called the College of Cardinals. So who are the cardinals? The cardinals are the equivalent of the minister. So what do you have in the Canadian Parliament? You have a minister of
finance,
a minister of defense,
agriculture.
The list goes on and on. So within the Roman Catholic tradition, they have cardinals who are ministers of all these particular bureaucracies. But there is an interesting thing about Catholicism. more than one.
What else is this? We've got this thing called the Roman Catholic Church. So that refers to the religious body that we find in every country in the world with this long tradition that goes all the way back to Peter, the recalcitrant, tough, hard-assed fisherman. But that's not all of it. What else is there? What else is there that you can't... I mean, in a way, you can think of the Roman Catholic Church by itself, but every once in a while, you're going to be forced to have to consider this other element, or this other garment. I'm not sure what to call it. This other face, this other dimension. And what is that?
Are you talking about its universality?
No, just before you came in, we talked about the universality a little bit.
Is that what the hope that it gives a lot of people? Like the
hope?
Religion, like the faith? That
the hope usually comes out of the faith, yeah.
I don't know if that's what you're going
on. That's not another garment, I don't think.
Okay.
I think that's very central to the gift of the religious faith.
There's this other dimension. And the Pope is kind of a curious figure in this. The Pope is El Papa. I mean, it represents the unity of the Church. The full unity of the Church is the way in which the Pope is understood. But there's this other thing.
The political?
No. Merklin. The Lutheran. Mm-hmm. No, that's you see, the Roman Catholic Church is this universal religion, and then it is what I like to call the last of the Italian city-states. It's a state. It's a really small state. How many acres? 23 acres or something? But it's a state. So when the Pope came to Alberta, we paid the bill. Because he came as the head of state, as well as the Pope. So this has given Roman Catholicism an amazing history and an amazing way of thinking. Because it has to think in two registers. It has to think in the register of faith, and how the theological tradition and the spiritual disciplines, how those work to illuminate life, or how they work to challenge the difficulties of life. But they also have to think about this in terms of state. It's a peculiar state. It's an unbelievably peculiar state. It's the only state in the world that doesn't... My apologies... care about children. You know what? There ain't none. There were a few once in a while hidden away somewhere, maybe. Because the city Vaticano is made up of little more than celibate men.
At least they're supposed to be celibate. Some of them are, some of them aren't.
And some women, usually religious, who've been there as well. So it's a curious state. But this is one of the real gifts of, I think it's a gift of the Roman Catholic Church, is that it has this other dimension. So that leads to a very textured kind of thinking. And sometimes it leads to people being enormously frustrated with it, because it doesn't just speak with a religious voice. It also speaks with a real eye to the fact that it is also a state. It is a gift, and it's a challenge. Just a couple more things. El Papa. What do you make of the Pope?
I don't mean a particular Pope, but that position.
You've already said a few things about it. You've said very influential.
One of our colleagues here talked about the Pope can speak and, you know, millions and millions of people pay attention. And then authoritarian, the notion that the church and the Pope have a kind of authority, which is pretty remarkable in the world. Maybe you could say a little bit more about how you think of that authority. What do you think of that authority? You said authoritarian, didn't you?
Yeah, well.
I don't think you meant that in a particularly fond way, did you?
No, I think it's dangerous when you try to use certain religious convictions to try to force things a certain way in the world that aren't necessarily good. I mean, sometimes the authority that he exerts on all the believing Catholics, because it's like, you know, there's like a billion Catholics in the world, so to them at least it holds weight, and then they affect policy in their states or whatever that they want a certain way, and then sometimes the results aren't really good, I find. Sometimes they are. Sometimes they're like, you know, he has legitimate grievances with things, but then sometimes it's just some things like, people with AIDS shouldn't use condoms because you should only have sex to procreate or something, right? That's, or whatever, right?
Sure, that's a little bit difficult, a little curious that
yeah.
Does that. Yeah. Interesting, huh? Let's unwrap the word just a touch. Authority. What's at the heart of that word?
Authorship.
To author. To bring into being. To give some form to things. There are really three kinds of authority within. I think these three kinds of authority occur in all religions, but certainly the Roman Catholic one is a wonderful example. And it's worth thinking about these as distinct, related but distinct. There's the authority of experience. That's something most of us are big on. We really believe in the authority of experience as modern people. In fact, most of us think our experience has much more authority than anything else. But so do you have this in the Catholic tradition. Look at the mystics, particularly. Great examples of people that had an experience in their life which was transformative and led them down a path of holiness. No matter what the next level of authority was saying. The next level of authority is institutional authority. That's why you have mystics, Teresa of Avila, Catherine of Siena, being two that come immediately to mind, the founder of the Ursulines, Marguerite Bourgeois, Canada's first saint, marvelous woman from France that came and built the first school in Canada, which was a girls' school, in Ville Saint Marie, all of whom at least ignored the bishop and the pope, and on occasion read the riot act to them. They were listening to a different drummer. And they're part of the church. Hildegard of Bingen, I think, is a curious example, taken up by the modern women's movement as if she wasn't a Catholic. She was deeply Catholic and deeply committed to what she was up to there. So institutional authority is something that most of us moderns are critical of, at least particularly if it's a religious institution. Not when it comes to the university so much, or business so much. But there's a third kind of authority, and you can't understand religion without it, and that's the authority of tradition. And the authority of tradition is an umbrella over institutional authority and the authority of personal experience. It critiques both over time. and draws new things out from both. So it's just useful to, in your thinking about these matters. But let's return to this issue of the authority of the Pope, just so we're clear on something. The Pope has, what's the Pope's ultimate authority, as you would see it?
Well, for me, nothing really, but...
What do you mean, for you, nothing? You're a very pious young man. I know that he... You know, the Pope talked to me this morning, and he mentioned your name. Well, of course, all the time. No, I don't mean to. Fun. Do you have a notion of what the Pope's, what you might think the Pope's ultimate authority is?
Well, what he thinks it is, or what?
Okay, yeah, what he thinks it is.
Well, he thinks
not what you think it is.
Well, he thinks he's got, like, you know, the blessing of God to be his spokesperson on earth, right? And then I don't think any person should have that. Have that kind of power, but I don't know. His authority just comes from Catholics listening to him. I mean, because they believe that he's God's spokesperson, or at least the ones that do. So people That's listening to him gives him authority.
God's spokesperson on earth. Good.
And I think a lot of authority comes, like, simply with the title and the position that he's in, and because of the reputation that has been guarded over the years of the Pope.
So there's a concept called papal infallibility. Have you heard of that concept? The Pope speaking an infallible word. Now, the only other place, I mean, you've all had an experience with this because you're students of Dietmar Mundos. And Dietmar Mundos speaks infallible. And you better remember them. So papal infallibility is a teaching of the Church. It's a relatively recent teaching of the Church, of the Roman Catholic Church, although it has a long tradition behind it. And let's hold it in tension here just a little bit with this notion of being God's spokesperson. Infallibility is this teaching of papal infallibility does not refer to everything the Pope says. Although some popes maybe wish it did, but it doesn't. It refers only to what the Pope says. There's a kind of nice Latin formula to it. Ex cathedra. You know what cathedra is? It's a chair. When he speaks from the chair of Peter, the Apostle Peter, on matters of dogma. So our colleague here who talked about this extraordinary thing of rejecting condom use for people with AIDS, with the notion that if you have sexual intercourse, there ought to be a baby coming along. That wasn't ex cathedra. It's a teaching. It's not the truth.
Yeah, I don't think they would appreciate that distinction.
They have articulated that distinction far better than you and I have. It's central to Catholic teaching. That doesn't mean that what's said there isn't important and isn't something they go to the bar on. But there is a distinction here. I just wanted to put that in front of you before our guest begins to lecture about these things. These things exist in several different layers within the Catholic tradition. So I want to introduce you to Bert Pitzel, who's the social justice coordinator for the Archdiocese of Regina. And he is, if you think the Pope is the spokesperson of God, Bert is the spokesperson of the Pope. So, I hope I've set him up nicely, given that you've got these things up here, so you can examine him according to those. He's been the social justice coordinator in Regina for 18 years. He is a Saskatchewan boy, and needless to say, he's feeling pretty good today. As you know, even Catholics in Saskatchewan view their Catholicism as important, but they view the temple cult of football as ultimate. So, if you're wearing green, you're in luck tonight. He was a teacher for a long time, and one of the things that that is of interest to me is that he has said to me that he has a long interest also in the mystical teachings of the Catholic tradition and the way those also speak to political issues in our world. He's going to speak to us tonight about the way in which the teaching of the Catholic Church on the nature of society and the nature of the economy, the way in which that stands really as a kind of, to use one of Dittmar's favorite terms, a kind of prophetic witness to a different way of thinking about the economy and about our life together in the world. So I'm very glad that he's here, and I will mention just one little story by way of introduction, because it speaks to our colleagues and a lot of the uneasiness that exists that leads to this kind of set of things and the concerns that they express. A number of years ago, it probably is now, my Lord, it's 20 years ago, I was talking with the great historian of Christian ideas, Yaroslav Pelikan. We were at the Yale Club in New York, and it was lunch, and I don't recall what all we were on about together, but at one point in the conversation, Yaroslav Pelikan said something to me that I've never forgotten. Yaroslav Pelikan was Lutheran, and of course he was the editor of Luther's work, gave all the great lectureships in the humanities around the world, a genius, remarkable person. One of the few Protestants that popes requested to visit with when they came to North America. So he had spent time one-on-one with John Paul II, with John the 23rd. On a number of occasions. Now, back in the 60s, when was Humanae Vitae, Bert?
1968,
I was living in Montreal. A papal encyclical, which really means letter, it's a teaching letter to bishops, called Humanae Vitae, was published. Now, it's interesting. You see, encyclicals in the old days were letters that the Pope would write or the Magisterium would write, the Pope would sign, and send it out to the bishops around the world. And the bishops would read that letter, and it was meant to help them in their pastoral ministry, to help them think about issues and to teach people well. Now, prior to the modern world, those encyclicals would take quite a long time to get there around the world, to the various Catholic bishops. In the old days, they were always written in Latin. So some of your bishops probably didn't even know Latin all that well. Or if they did, they thought its meaning was only in Latin. If they were the bishop of a place which was Tigaloo, how do you translate from Latin to Tigaloo? But by 1968, we had a whole new world. So an encyclical would go viral. It no longer was a closed letter to the bishops around the world. It became a public document overnight. And I think Humanae Vitae was probably the first one that really, in a substantive way, became a public document overnight. And in it, there was this argument about what, in its beautiful language, is called the conjugal embrace. The loving, lovemaking between wives and husbands. And in it, because we have the advent of modern chemical birth control, in it was an argument that the act of lovemaking is intended for procreation. And this is written for Catholics, of course, if you deliberately impede that, you are in some way sinning against God's order and the order of creation. And that's where our colleagues' critique about what happened more recently around AIDS and condoms goes back to this encyclical and to this teaching. So that's the context for this little brief story. I'm talking to Pelikan, this great genius. And in the course of the conversation, he says to me, "You know, David, the Roman Catholic Church has the finest social teaching of any organization or any school of thought in the modern world. There is nothing like it." From the 60s on to the 90s, when we were talking, the late 90s, it is the finest body of teaching about the social life, about the economy, about work, about the whole range of things. Nothing like it. But, he said, it isn't taken seriously. And then he said this: "If I was Beelzebub..." Do any of you know who Beelzebub is? You smile. You've had a relationship. Beelzebub's a lovely word for the devil. Can you all say it? Beelzebub. "If I was Beelzebub, I would have whispered Humanae Vitae into the ear of Paul the Sixth." It was Paul the Sixth, wasn't it?
Yeah. That's right.
"Knowing that that teaching would make it impossible for any sensible human being who was not Catholic to take the most profound teaching about social justice and our life in society seriously from this particular teaching body." Amazing. And on that note, I invite somebody who takes it seriously and for you to engage him. Great to have you, Bert.
Thank you very much. So I'm your Catholic specimen to be observed and maybe prodded and probed later on. I have to tell you, make a confession to you, I love Catholicism. But over 20 years ago, I shocked the heck out of one of my Anglican friends because he didn't know how anybody could love Catholicism. And I guess it's not because I felt tenderness and gentleness coming out of the institution. That isn't my experience at all as a Catholic. My mom had a big right arm, and I felt it. It was discipline, that sort of thing. But I think I was attracted to it because of its courage, in my view, in pursuit of the truth. No holds barred. Go pursue it. And it was always, in a sense, beyond my reach. But at least I had something to reach for. That was what was given to me, what I trusted and believed. I first of all should say this. When I came here and saw some of the gigantic intellects that I met at the Philosopher's Cafe, and David is certainly one of them, I think I was like the disciples, the rural fishermen, who first saw the temple. Their eyes grew wide. But I'll refrain from saying what Jesus said, that these will fall. I should be intimidated. But I went to my dogma, and I said, just hold on a second here. You have been given a gift to be given. And that is all your responsibility is. Just give what it is that you have been given to give. Show up. Listen carefully. Speak with integrity. And let go of the results. You know? That's all you got. And I did so at the Philosopher's Cafe, and it was a marvelous experience. I love the idea, and I'll use the seasonal term, I love to kick off the conversation. You know? And then the conversation grew. And I compared that a little bit to WrestleMania, where 10 people are thrown in the ring, and the last one in is the winner. I woke up the next morning with a large heart, a larger heart, because the conversation was so rich, and I felt that I hadn't been thrown out of the ring by the people that were there. So I really felt indebted. Just to get to the point, I first of all feel mentored by Benedict. Many people have tried to read Caritas in Veritate, which is Charity in Truth, which was written following the collapse, the economic collapse in 2008. And he wanted to do an analysis of what it is that the economy should be. So came up with this image of bloodletting. I like to give blood every 5 weeks. When I go to the bank, I give blood. There's a difference. When I go to the blood clinic, I give, but I don't lose anything. I have a sense of giving, and I'm received. And I love the energy in that room. Whenever there are volunteers who are giving of themselves for the sake of, it's a wonderful spirit in there. And the one who will take won't take away from me. He will take, but I will gain, and they will gain. And in short terms, that is the kind of economy that Pope Benedict is talking about. It's called often the economy of communion. Remember who you are as a human being. And when you participate, you can't afford to lose who it is that you are given to be. Because if you lose that, then you've lost the whole thing. Now, when I go into the bank, at least in my earlier days, to get a loan to pay for the house, I don't like paying three times the amount that the house is worth. I don't like the idea, the way currency is made, where the only way that currency is created is by taking out a loan with interest to be paid back, which right away sets everybody in competition because there isn't enough currency in circulation to pay back both the principal and the interest. So you have to compete with other people to get what they borrowed so that you can pay back your loan and the interest. And it's a surefire formula for exploiting the earth, because where else do you make money? And so I don't like that about going to the bank, because I'm hooking into I will say a capitalistic system that starts right there. So in that system, when I give, I lose. It's not the same as giving in blood. I lose because somebody else wants to maximize their profit. And when they take away from you. And those are the fundamental differences in giving and taking. There is such a giving that you gain. There is such a giving that you lose. Now, Benedict said this, and many people throw this book away in frustration because they don't know what the heck, where is this coming from, and where is it going to? It seems to be swirling around and all that kind of stuff. But for some strange reason, I get determined. And when I wrestle with this, it's like Jacob wrestling with the angel. And the wrestling match is so that Jacob will get stronger. And this is, of course, me speaking, right? So I read this, and it's almost as if Benedict is saying, have you had enough now? And I say, yes. And then he's almost saying, well, come back when you're ready for some more. Now, this invitation to come back here was another opportunity. I read this in 2009, and I had my head in it, and my head in it, and I gave some little presentations and that sort of thing. But then when I get this invitation back, another time I thought I better find out which chapter was most relevant here and what would speak to the question. It was chapter 3. It was called Fraternity, Economic Development, and Civil Society. And I'd just like to give you the core of what he is saying here. Basically, he's saying that, in one of the books that was mentioned, something about matters.
It was Winterberry, What Matters.
The whole idea, and I think it comes from that, because I tried to quickly glance over your reading books, you know, the ones that you had, Court, and I knew I was one of my heroes and so forth. But basically what I saw was the idea that if you get the 99% who are being exploited by the 1%, you know, the global casino bidders, and you insist on justice, the 99 certainly have more of a power base, you would think, than the 1%. And then perhaps in this gathering of the 99%, and if you had the right conversations and the right leadership and so forth, then you could create a whole new way of doing business, a whole economy. And Benedict isn't against that. Certainly justice is a highly prized principle. But he's saying this. It is so much about who you are. And if you participate in a way that isn't about who you are, then you lose. And so he argues for an economy that is a win-win-win situation. Just let me frame out what he, some of the parts of what he says in that chapter. He says, and he starts out gently, he says, in some quarters, there is an understanding that there has to be a new model of development. Generally, in secular society, when you talk about development, you're talking about, in a sense, really only economic development. He says there has to be a new model of development, and he said a new approach to the economy. Then he goes on, and he identifies development as integral and solidary development. Basically, he says, you can know development by its completeness. If it doesn't include the whole person and every person in the human family, it's not development, is what he's saying. It's got to include the whole person, all their dimensions, and all people. And then when he goes on to the economy, he doesn't even name it the economy. He says the common good, meaning that the economy should work towards the common good in society. Later on, he'll say that that's going to be the role of the political community, unless it's taken over from the inside, so that the boys of the economy that want to make big money also run the political community. Then you have this going on. So he said, when you're thinking about development, integral and solidarity, and the common good, or the economy, it requires a correct balance, a correct scale of goods and values. Yes, you need goods, but you need values. And he says, a wide variety of goods and a wide variety of choices, as important as they might be to development, have to be weighed against the horizon of a good life. An upright life, he said, that sees the priority of the spiritual and the call to work for the common good. He calls it a call, the call to work for a common good. So he frames that out. So that's not what's going on. Chapter 2 is all about that, what is really going on. And then he says, what is needed now is us to be who we are, which is creative human beings. Created in the image and likeness of a creative God, we are creative. We can't abandon that. Creative people, individuals, in groups, and in institutions, working at creating a new economy so that it looks totally different than the one we have that has been put in place and that we support in some measure in our daily living. Then he talks about the economy that we presently have. He says, in a global way, and then we bite into it, Naomi Klein goes into how this global economy wasn't chosen. He thought, and the great argument is that, yes, the way it is just kind of was natural and it evolved to be that, and she shows that it's not that. That when people were in shock, then they forced these neoliberal policies into various nations. He says that the global economy and the spirit of the economy is really maximize profits. In the business that you do, it is common sense to maximize profits and view people in terms of their capacity to compete with one another. That's what's going on. He said, but what we must do is remember who we are. We are people who are made for gift. Let me give you a stab at from Colossians and the book of Genesis why that would be. And you can critique this. But we believe, in Christians believe, the triune God. Three persons, one God. A God that is community. The Father we recognize as the source of all being in life. And the Father couldn't exist by himself in singularity, or the source couldn't exist in singularity, if that were to be recognized in love, because where's the action? You know, love you recognize in relationship. And so it makes all the sense in the world that the source of all being in life would beget someone to whom he could give all that is his to give. Someone who could receive. Now we've got some action going on. I'm talking about the Godhead prior to the creation of the cosmos. So, the second person, the eternally begotten Son, the one to whom the source gives all that is his to give. Now, before he can think of it, the Father, who is the source of everything, also brings about a third person that is very necessary. Because the person to whom he's giving to might say, just hold on a second here. Is this a good deal? Maybe this is a Trojan horse operation here. and you're giving to me as a setup. But that can't be. Even before the thought comes, the third is the revealer who reveals the meaning and value of this dynamic of giving and receiving. That what will happen is a profound interpenetration, a communion of joy. And so what you have then is what we call a God of love, existing by himself, three persons, one. So then, let me go on at the beginning of the cosmos. So then, and this is me speaking again, the source says to the sun, wouldn't it be a good idea if I gave to you one such as yourself, who could receive all that is given, and who could return, first of all, live out and return thanksgiving, and enter into our communion of joy. Wouldn't that be a good idea? The sun would say, count me in. That's a really good plan. And I am going to be a crucial part of this, because the ones who are to come will, if you like, mimic and participate in what it is that I am doing. My imprint will be in there. And within them will be a vibe that basically says, receive and give, receive and give. So that's in the essence of who we have been created to be. And by the way, there's a material word, a cosmos, just so that in community, it's no wonder that we have a social nature. God is three in one, so why wouldn't we have a social nature? And in our responding, we would seek to have the unity that God has in himself. And I just say perfectly that God is absolute unity. He's total transparency. And the bonding is complete. So why wouldn't we seek solidarity, oneness of the family? That's kind of the pinnacle part of the social teachings that we are to have, because it's in our very constitution to want to be one with all of those who are one with God. So then Benedict puts it this way. We are created to be gift. In other words, what is repeated over and over in the essence of our being is receive what is given, accept what is given, and return, give, be a giver. And so when people enter into that, they are fully being themselves. And so when Benedict speaks about the economy, he says, we can't allow the economy to cause us to be different than we are. Central to the economy that we have right now is the so-called free market, and where you have what we call commutative justice, where it's exchange of things of equivalent value. So I have a thing, and you have a thing, and by cultural configurations, they seem to be equivalent, so we exchange. And that's it. That's what it's based on. I got something. Okay, you have something. We exchange. And I'm saying that kind of relationship doesn't produce a sense of trust. It doesn't produce a solidarity. It's just that. And so if we lower ourselves just to doing that, then we have, as it were, a real toning down of who it is that we are. And he says, therefore, we must come up with a different way of doing business. So that in the very action of the economy, I can be gifting. I give and I don't lose. I gain. I gain a friend. That's why it's fraternity. When I give in the economy, I gain a friend. When I receive, that bonding becomes complete. And so that is sort of what marks the view of the economy that must come to be, as put into place by creative human beings, which isn't here yet. The economy that we presently have didn't come from Mount Sinai or Mount Olympus or any other thing. It came in by the dynamics of human behavior. And so he's saying we should not be confined and controlled by that. Now, to be creative, he says, is very difficult. Because look at the economy as it is right now. It's an economy which is structured that money must make more money. That's one thing. It's structured now, we find ourselves in international relationships that we have signed. We have speculation. People can use food as a poker chip. Bid on corn. Send the stock up. Make money all the way up. Then you have an instrument which recognizes when it's going to begin to fall. Now you bet in reverse. Now you make money all the way down. You know? So you have this casino operation that is perfectly legal. It's accepted, as it were. And he also said technology has become almost the new ideology. If you can make something faster and bigger and so forth, go for it. And then it swings so much of what the human behavior is going to be. Try and shut one of those big shovels down at Fort McMurray. You know, there's a lot of money invested in that. So it becomes the tail that wags the dog, in a sense, in so many senses. And then you have an economy that exploits the earth. You know? And brings about now all of this because of the injustices, great migration of peoples and refugees, that sort of thing. So he's saying, stepping back, okay, we're calling people to be creative, and it ain't gonna be easy. But you are creative, and remember, he says, the power of small. The yeast rises the whole bread. The salt gives flavor to the whole soup. Or the batch. The light lights up the whole room. You know? The mustard seed starts very small and then it grows. So keep in mind the power of small. It will win the day. And then just to go on to define what he's looking at, or to continue on what he's looking at in this economy of communion, he says that that our undertakings must produce bonds of fairness, you know, as expressions of fraternity between co-workers, between all of those involved in the economic process. The co-workers, the managers, customers, consumers, that whenever there's a dealing there, you should walk away with a friend. Not a neutral, well, I've exchanged an equal for an equal, but you should walk away with a friend. Then he goes on to say that states, they must articulate policies that, in fact, and he says agricultural and industrial policies, that in fact will consolidate democracies. You can articulate policies that tear apart democracies, you know, through international trade, and now you have, which is the pharmaceutical company going to sue Canada for, what is it, $500 million because of loss of profits. Well, we made the deal, and nobody knows we made the deal. So we have our leaders arranging these kinds of things, and these kind of undertakings then don't strengthen democracy. So it must strengthen democracy, and it must as well bring about constitutional reform for the sake of the people. Then he goes into, we must create ethical structures of currency, of financial and commercial markets. And what these must be, they must be stabilized, they must be coordinated, and controlled so that the poor don't suffer. Like, if you aren't controlling financial markets, which you see as a cloud seeking to replicate itself, feasting off its host, which is going to be the people at work, the real economy, you know. Let's see, where was I here? I was saying that we must that we have to control these financial and commercial markets so that the poor don't suffer. So if the corn price goes bouncing up and down, or oil prices go bouncing up and down, who the hell cares? As long as we're making money, what happens to people who depend on that price? And then he finally said, and he talks about the small rural holdings. You know, big is better. Basically, he's saying that local, national, and international governments must work in solidarity so that those workers of small rural holdings will be able to live sustainably, economically, socially, and environmentally, and work with dignity. So that's his vision. And so, is this possible, becomes the question. And that's where you go into that whole economy of communion. And there are now, if you want to Google it, over 700 companies that are trying to do that sort of thing. That the profits that they make, part is to sustain and build the business. Another part are those people who are needy, poor. The third part, he said, is to try and affect the culture, the values of the culture. Because in a competitive world like we have, the values of the culture are individualism, consumerism, and utilitarianism. And he says what we must do in this culture of communion, this is what will happen. We'll have a culture that values fraternity, reciprocity, and solidarity. And maybe just one last piece on it. He, in Catholic social teachings, it talks about globalization as a positive with great possibilities. Because we are one human family, and why doesn't it make sense that resources all over the world should somehow benefit people who don't have these kinds of things? But he says that globalization has to be upheld by two basic principles. One is solidarity, the other is subsidiarity. Now let me tell you what subsidiarity means. It means that the individual person is valued because of their dignity. And the power of that person must never be supplanted by something bigger, must not be controlled. He said that, if you want a technical definition, it says that decisions must be made at the lowest level of social coexistence that are competent. The lowest level of social organization is a better word. I'll go at it again. But subsidiarity is that the decision should be made at the lowest level of social organization in which there is competence. Or you could say that decisions should be made nearest the individual occurring in their local community. So solidarity means we have to act as a human family, which means that I feel a responsibility for my brother, my sister, wherever they are, and I will take action. So I feel responsibility for everybody, but then the decision must come down to the individual. And in this process, the eye must be on the individual person who lives in a community, the community which is organized by the common good, by an expression of the common good. So those are some pretty powerful big ideas. But that works at the local level. And if you keep applying it, it should be able to surround the earth. I like to call it nested and networking. Nested, you know, like an egg in a nest, and the community is kind of the nest itself. So you have to build a nest in the local community, and then others do, and others do, but then they must be networked, and agreements be offered to one another, to everybody's benefit, you see. I guess this one last thing. John Paul II had talked about the civil society, the market, and the civil society. He said, or the market and the state is a better way of saying it. He said that traditionally this is the way we've done it. The economic power engine goes and does its profit-making thing. But then the political arena over here is supposed to look at that and say, well, hold on a second, people are being hurt. So let's act so that there is some kind of redistribution with taxes and that sort of thing. And he said that's the way it's traditionally happened. I guess that's not too bad, perhaps, although we're losing out on this being gift. But he says now with this new form of globalization, now that state is no longer able to act with the same kind of force and power that it did before, because now the economy, the global economy, integrates all the other economies, and by God, the way that operates can break the currency of any country. So it better step up to the plate and concede to the wishes of the betters, you know. So there's that. But he said, now that that is the new reality, so much more the reason that the canons of justice be applied in every stage of the economic process. Financing, let the canons of justice prevail there. Location of resources, you know, how we handle that. Let the canons of justice. Then you have production and then consumption. And so there is no part of the economic process that doesn't involve ethical behavior as a whole thing. But there was one more thing.
That's lots. That was your one last thing. Okay. That was great.
Okay, I did a lot of last things, so I thought I should do one more.
The last things. No, don't go away.
I
think we should take a break for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then come back and we'll talk together. You can explore what Bert has laid out here and you can push it around a little bit.
Yeah.
Good. Thanks so much. Yeah. So let's begin to talk together a little bit about this. The last comment that Bert made about the corporations which are endeavoring to take some of this papal teaching seriously reminded me of that lovely trip I took. Research trip I took to Belgium, which involved looking at Reformation art and going to monastery breweries. The Cistercians who are still brewing beer, all these extraordinary beers in Belgium. And one of the things that I found out from the brewmaster, normally the brewmaster is still a monk, but a bearer of the tradition. But they employ people from the town and what have you.
One of the things that was so interesting to me is that in many cases with these monasteries, Orval, for example, some of you may have drunk Orval beer, they limit their growth. That is, they've decided to scale and no more. They're not interested in extending their market. Many of them just market locally. And they do this because of their sense that the local community that participates in the work they're doing, they want them to be able to work well and to have an opportunity to take feast days properly. And then what they said is that in terms of the economic work or the profit of the monastery, that they have a rule of thumb that one-third of the profit is given to the poor, one-third of it goes back into the business, and one-third of it is used largely for things like education in no doubt education largely within the Catholic tradition. So it just reminded me that that model has been around for a while. And maybe it's appropriate that Benedictus is named Benedictus, because these monasteries are all part of that Benedictine world. So Bert, come on up here and let's talk together and see what people want to pick up on and push around. What do you make of this? Sound utopian and crazy? Is there anything in it that you want to think about? How does it square with what you've been reading? Are there pieces of it you'd like to understand better? Where would you like to go?
That is pretty on par with things that we've learned so far. Learning about things, stuff like that. Which didn't really surprise me, because like we talked about all class, that like the root of religion, like when you first landed, like the root of all major, not just like Catholicism. Sure, if we had someone else that knew like the different like Islam or something like that, it'd be probably very similar teachings and similar like values, the way the economy has gone awry. So I thought it was like it's interesting to see it from like a Catholic point of view, but it's like on par with what many religions also teach, and also what we've been learning in class.
Others? Would you like to query? Yeah.
Well, I mean,
people, be straightforward. don't hold back.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, we have to change ourselves. You say that, you know, we have to, the whole person has to change, all dimensions and all people. But well, some people are psychopaths, right? So it's not like we can expect everybody to uphold this new view of, like, I mean, sure, it's nice to have the idea that, you know, we should all be sharing things, but the reason some people are up there in the economic ladder is probably because they don't share anything, because their method of thinking is, they actually are psychopaths. So
yeah, they are.
Because it's so ingrained, that method of thinking is so ingrained that they can't think any other way. I mean, and it only depends on those few people in a way that, you know, sure, if we can change everybody's hearts, but not everybody thinks the same way, right?
I don't find that different from what we've been learning in class, though. Like, I know that's on par with everything out of that.
Yeah.
Like, there's always going to be people that don't or care for anything, but I don't know.
Would you like the Pope, given your sense of his authority and the fact that he can be oppressive, to actually force this change on these people, maybe? Your point is that, I mean, this is a teaching which is meant sort of critically, or to use Dittmar's terms, prophetically, to try and invite people to a new way of thinking. And of course, it's never going to be taken up by everybody, because you're right. Some people suffer from diseases.
One point that I think relates to that in a strong way is Benedict says, he relates truth and love together, just so that we aren't entering into some sloppy notion of what love is, you know. So the truth of love. He says that truth must be sought, found, and expressed in the economy of charity. And charity must be understood, confirmed, and practiced in the light of truth. They go together. Now he says that these things aren't something that you can will into your own life, or plan, or even study. He's not saying you shouldn't study, or you shouldn't want. He says that basically, these things come and impose themselves on you, transcending every law of justice, he said. Nobody deserves it. And he says, when we learn the truth about God's love, he says that opens us up to gift, the gift that God has for us, and that we are gift to. And he says then what we have...
It moves you beyond normal forms of justice.
Pardon me?
And moves you beyond normal forms of justice.
That piece in there too. But he says what happens is then you can have a hope that is lost when you look at the kind of economy that now is in action, where the economic process is seen to be autonomous and it has to be shielded from every influence of morality, you know. He says, and that view of economics influences all the other social structures. And what they do then is they come and they trample on personal and social freedoms, and then you start losing hope. So where do you go from there? You get, I'm mad as hell and I won't take this up, you know, all of that kind of thing. He says, the truth of God's love imposes itself on you, and then you can gain hope. It opens you up to gift, God's gift, and that you then have hope that you can participate in a developmental process. And he says, hope, what it does is it encourages the mind and strengthens it to direct the will so that you can participate. So what is needed then is something above and beyond the scientific method or the fact that I can chastise myself or discipline myself into a learning. You know? And again, we don't discourage any of those things. But he said fundamentally, truth isn't something we create. It's out there. It's the truth of God, and it imposes itself, and then that opens us up to gift. And so that then is the beginning of a transformation. And it's interesting that I think God uses every one of us in our own different way and experience. So we might have been crushed. We might have had injustices and that sort of thing, which we worked through. And it's usually in that particular arena that we are called then to get busy. In Vatican II documents, it talks about hope and joy. That if you don't have hope and joy, you have nothing to give. That's it. Because that's the only thing that can fire people up in some way. And it talks about reading the signs of the times. Now, what are the signs of the times? Well, he's saying that God is still a liberation God. You know, we read the story of the Hebrews and how God was listened and heard their cries and that sort of thing. God hasn't changed. He's still a liberation God. So he's saying, what you do in reading the signs of the times is you look where God is acting to liberate people. And then you discern whether you should join them in that kind of movement. Or you discern whether you should be taking initiative to bring that about. But fundamentally then, liberation then is an interest of God. It's his prime interest. And that's why in this little story of the second person takes flesh. And now that which is sort of churning away in the essence of our being takes on flesh and can speak to us in human terms to clarify. He says that what Jesus does is he purifies and deepens the impoverishment of our search for truth and love. And he says he is the face of truth and love. And there's more to this, but maybe I've said enough of that.
Father, yeah, please.
An economic theory has been formulated by individuals in specific economic times. And I don't see Pope Benedict's, from what you've said of it, as being something that the economic world is going to take hold of and embrace. But I think a people's movement might take hold of it and embrace. I think a people's movement is maybe the only possibility for implementing something of this nature.
Yeah, and they address that. He says that that typically it has been economics, act the way you're going to act, and then state, try and balance it out so there's distributive justice. He says, but in the economy of communion, he says we have to leave that model behind and go right to civil society and put into play the essence with your brother, your sister, your neighbors, and that sort of thing, so that in the way that you do business, whatever that turns out to be, in common sense, you make friends, if I want to put it that way. And when you do it that way, he says it becomes attractive. People will be drawn to that. And I guess it's always the same question.
Do you think even greedy people would be attracted to that?
Greedy people are missing a resource.
They're missing genuine relationship.
That's it. And that's an emptiness. They come out short. Don't tell me that that Kevin O'Leary's I Love Money and Greed is the Engine of Society. Don't tell me that that doesn't shrink the person inside. Because I think, after all, we can't prescind our nature. We can't do a Michael Jackson on our soul and try and do reconstructive surgery. We might try to do it. But the thing is, we are who we are, and what he's saying, who we are is gift.
Now, let me just ask those of you who are comfortable, you in just a minute. Yeah. Those of you who are doing the course sort of formally here, do you buy this notion? This kind of notion of what it means to be human? Or how do you see that? And where is greed in that? So,
could I ask the question?
Yeah, sure.
I think there's a lot of really great thoughts here, and I mean, going back to smaller rural holdings and local and self-sustaining and all these things, but do you see that the Catholic Church is really embracing this concept and like promoting it? Because I see, to be honest, I can see the Catholic Church is very set in their ways and very proud in that, and I think some of these movements do need to work with others and expand beyond that. So what is the
development and peace, which is the Catholic arm of the developing world. This year, the project is about mining. Yeah. And what we need is an arm, but the project before was exactly that, the small rural holdings. And they would do a wonderful analysis that we think that we're the breadbasket of the world, as Saskatchewan does and all that kind of thing. They say no. That it's this subsistence farming that feeds over two-thirds of the world's population. So if...
Not agribusiness.
No.
That's right. So if we try to reconfigure this, then what we're doing is we're stamping out that which is satisfying subsidiarity and solidarity in that way, and what we want to do is encourage and support that model. So they did a whole year of that, and when Catholics get together and they sign these postcards and so forth, and usually it's beating a dead horse to try to get politicians to listen to that, but yeah, you get over 300,000-400,000 signatures with postcards sent into Ottawa, you know. So, the guts of Catholicism is in the parish and the people. And if you go to any parish, look at the bulletin board and see what they're putting on the bulletin board and what they're wanting their people to listen to and respond to. And all I'm saying is that that was last year's program, was the small rural holdings. And
but
that's good.
But Bert is saying that this exists within the Catholic Church, but you're saying you see something else. What do you see?
Are they doing initiatives to expand beyond that? Like, because if they truly believe that we're all humans and in God's children, and like on each other, is there that love extended, or is it just within the Catholic family?
Oh, see, this is what Catholicism is about, in my view, that every person can detect a conscience, a call to do good and to avoid evil that comes from, I'll use the word voice, not of your own creating, that it's part of the creation of the human person. So Catholicism is about embracing that, so that every person on earth, you know, is supposed to be served in some way to have that view of themselves. And always the conscience, a well-formed conscience. And in Catholicism, the conscience has supreme authority.
They don't believe it's like the voice of God.
No, well, Joan of Arc was burnt to death because she heard these voices and was a witch and all that kind of stuff. But I'm saying that that you can have a sense and a realization that there is a conscience. You wake up in the morning, and if you've done something not so good the night before, when you wake up in the morning, there it is. You know, and you know instinctively what is right and what is not. Serial killers will talk about waking up in the morning and seeing the horror of what they had done the night before. You know? But then way leads on to way, and pretty soon they're unable to control themselves. So then the question for us is, where does this come from, where we can in fact be transformed to be the person we're created to be, mm-hmm. which is that generous, self-giving person, which is what the conscience calls us to be. So these, by and large, these teachings have got nothing to do with an appendage of religion. It has to do, who is the human person and what are they called to do, period.
An argument about human nature.
Yeah, it's about human nature.
I mean, not to buy the argument, that's how it understands itself, as an argument about human nature.
Yeah.
And that every human being
has... How would you respond if someone were to say that, like, let's say, typically organized religion is probably the most inefficient charity in the world because it pretty much mostly exists, let's say, at least, first of all, probably perpetuate itself, and second of all, proselytize, maybe third of all, if some money remains over to, you know, do some social justice. Do you see the Catholic Church different in that regard? Or?
Well, I would say this. First of all, I'll go to this quote by Benedict. He says that religion is to advocate reconciliation and fellowship. And anything else is a false form of religion. Advocate reconciliation. Reconciliation with God, with yourself, with your brother, with your sister, with your enemy. And advocate fellowship. And then he talks about the false forms of religion. You know. So that is number one. In this whole structure...
But that's not quite to the point what he's asking.
Yeah, but then to maybe more to the point is if I get from the structure encyclicals that probe my thinking, you know, every time I read an encyclical, if I'm down there, it's going to pull me up because I think it speaks to my human nature. You know, it gives me a vision of things. I remember going to the legislature. There was this group from North Battleford who was going to come to the legislature, and they were going to pick it and something about compensation insurance and that sort of thing. So would I come? Oh, and would you just say an opening prayer? So I went there. How many people will be there? Oh, there'll be hundreds. So you get there and there's 20 people, that sort of thing. So you go there, and I led them with a prayer. And they said, would you come back tomorrow and do the same thing? And then I did it the third day. Well, about a year and a half later, I saw this prayer that I was reading. And it hit me. See, my head was in the social teachings at the time, and I just wrote a prayer from out of the guts of the social teaching, and I read it to them. And they who had been stomped on by the insurance companies and that sort of thing in cahoots with the legislation were sort of put down. And the social encyclicals and the teachings give people, it affirms their dignity. And that's what these guys needed, you know. So that's why they asked me back. And I didn't know that's what I was doing.
So let me just come back to this.
Okay.
So are you saying that there's an argument that charitable organizations, religious charitable organizations, are inefficient with their charity?
Can I phrase it a different way? Like, just should religious leaders even be getting, like, well, what makes it, you know, you teach all the social justice and things, but then should religious leaders even be getting paid for their, you know, for their religious, what is it, for their, like, being a minister, being a priest, or given, like, everybody can do those things, but then still do social stuff. Like,
I don't think that's tied to religion.
Yeah.
That's tied to
just a sec. Okay. I want to understand.
Okay. Yes.
I want to understand what you're trying to get at here.
I would agree with that. It's like, it's a different issue because they've devoted their lives to pastoring or leading people into this fellowship and reconciliation, but that does not negate the fact that they still live in an economic society. So
that is the way it is structured. The way it is now.
Yeah.
Like,
and that's
the
issue. Is that
yeah? Yeah, but wouldn't we all be better off to find an organization that, let's say, you know, actually does social justice in the world, but that it doesn't support religious ministers, and let's say give our money to them instead of, let's say, tithing to a church, like.
But where do you think morals come from?
You think it's a church?
I think there's some. He was just telling us about this voice.
I mean, he's talking about his
conscience.
Conscience.
Yeah. What
do you think?
You want to clarify?
Yeah, just ask more about the wealth of the church itself.
Yeah.
Is that
Well,
is that your. Just a sec. Just slow down. You've been probing two things here, it seems to me. One of them is. And as Phil put his finger on what the first one was, when you were saying that charities were inefficient, religious charities were inefficient, you were looking for some other kind of charitable and social justice organization which didn't do what you think the church does?
Well, the church, if you look at, I don't know if the Catholic Church is different, but if you look at, like, pretty much any church, it's like most of its budget is spent on, like, you know, if they have a larger budget, they'll hire more pastors, or they'll build a bigger building, or they'll, you know what I mean. I'm not saying the Catholic Church does this, because I think all their infrastructure has long been paid for centuries, but in certain places anyway. But I mean, it's kind of how I tend to view the church. I mean, sure, it has a good message, and it compels people to spend their time and their efforts in certain things, but I think in a lot of times it just ends the mostly perpetuating itself, because most of the efforts get spent on within the church itself.
But the institution of the church is supposed to be an institution not for itself. It's supposed to give itself away so that humanity as a whole will be enriched. And
that's the teaching.
That's the teaching. Catholics love their priests, basically. They are. Fights, you know, like there are things that bother them and so forth, but profoundly they love their priests, and there is a support given to sustain parish life. Of course, the center of Catholicism would be the Eucharist, you know, where you meet Jesus and the one who is love, and you want to become what you eat, which is love itself. So they're the kind of connection and the thing, the person that holds all of that together. And if you look at, say, the tsunami that hit a number of years ago, the Catholics responded, and we worked through Caritas in whatever country it was. The money went directly to boats and that sort of thing, whereas a great amount of the money that was collected outside in other agencies, not all, went to clearing that out and building high-rise apartments for, in other words, to advance that neoliberal concept of economics. So in this case, and I have great trust that the overhead is as low as it can possibly be because they want it to be that way. And the whole thing is Jesus the servant, you know. It's not Jesus the victorious ruler and that sort of thing, but Jesus the servant. And you find people on the ground doing that, you know. And so the percentage of administration for, say, Caritas in Cambodia and that, these kind of places, is as low as it can be, I would say.
You want to push back?
Well, how would you compare the person of Jesus who, like, said, give everything away and whatever, to, like, say, the Pope who, like, you know, lives in luxury and...
Oh, look at Pope Francis now. the movement from within. We live in a reality of time, and you do need structure and that sort of thing to take care of tomorrow. And if you give everything away, you have nothing. And how is that going to work, and where is that going to go? So I think common sense and judgment has to be mixed into that whole question of you're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself, so you should really feed yourself and clothe yourself and these kinds of things. But you can't be money must make more money. Greed is the engine of the economic life and all of that sort of thing. It's supposed to be humble service.
Don't worry, I agree. I think Jesus was wrong too.
What?
When he said, give everything away, kind of thing, that was probably not really...
Well, that was to the rich young man who had a specific set of questions, so he responded to what he was after. If you would be perfect, he said, God, I'm missing something. So, and he said, well, come on, let's be total gift, and I'll help you with that.
being part of the... world today relates to what I was going to say. It seems to me that the economic structure that we're living under now is similar to global warming. That the signs are so obvious, but people still refuse to see it or do anything about it. And it's like our economic structure. You look at the United States and the debt, and it's failing, and consumerism, and just having the economy grow for the sake of growth because that's supposed to make more is better kind of thing. It's not working. But how do you escape that? Even for us who can see that there is a better way. We live here and now in this world, and I have investments because I need to live in my old age, and I need some way to do that. So you're drawn into this economy even if you don't want to.
Yeah.
And it's sort of discouraging to look at this book that we've been reading because it seems so impossible. How can it ever change? But I think maybe change will come because the 99% will become so large and they will be out of the middle class because they're in the poverty class, and will be forced into a different economy. And Sharon was just telling me about an economy that she's a part of where it's kind of gone back to barter and that, because they don't have money.
Yeah.
And so maybe it'll be forced upon them.
Part of what I think the Pope is doing here, Benedict is doing here, if you just stand back from the document a little bit, he is giving a critique of what you're talking about and saying that one of the tragedies of the modern economy is that it's created such isolation, and it's created a circumstance in which people are not able in their own mind, they're not able to be dependent on each other. So what he's calling for, if I've understood this, he's saying, you know, we have to start not doing it that way. We have to start becoming dependent on each other. knowing that we are dependent on each other, and reshaping our life around solidarity, around a community of giving and receiving. So in that sense, it's speaking, I think, to your concern, but it is saying this, there's not going to be a revolution overnight that's going to do this. This is not going to be something the states are going to pick up on. The international thinkers around capitalism are not going to adopt this overnight. And whether you like it or not, or whether our Muslim brothers and sisters like it or not, Islamic economics isn't going to conquer the world overnight. So he's calling for speaking, if I've understood this, he's speaking to the faithful, and beyond that, to anybody else who might hear, and saying, you know what? In your nature, as a human being, you are capable of doing it differently. And of course, there are people that do it differently. There are people who are well off who do it differently, who don't live in those terms, but use what they have for the poor, but also for the creation of solidarity within communities. I also think that when Catholics speak about these things, they participate in a long tradition which also, admittedly, has this dominant mode, but it also has counterculture movements. Monasticism. What is monasticism? Monasticism was the coming together of women and of men who said the way in which the world is ordered is appalling, and I'm not going to do it that way anymore. And so they covenant together to live a different life, a counterculture life. And of course, monasteries become decadent, like everything, because we're human beings. But for periods of time, they really do it different. So part of the gift of religious traditions, and certainly of the Catholic tradition, is that it gives you these models which are different from the dominant one. And part of what I think the Pope is doing here is he's saying, listen to your better angels. Yeah. We can actually find a way.
And what can you do? It's not calling for a radical crashing and a turnaround, but I think it's kind of that conversion and always the question, so what can you do? To basically fulfill that hunger that's in your life, mm-hmm. because it's there because you're a human, being.
Helen.
I'm not sure how to phrase this, but...
I'm sure you'll find a way.
I'll draw from my experience. It's kind of a both and. I resonate with the young fellow here who's spoken. And as I've gone through your brochure here, the two feats is what I want to speak about. Mm-hmm. The charity model and the social action model. Now, I think, in contrary to what the perception is, actually, churches do a very good job of charity. They're very efficient. They're very effective. I think I've heard, not sure, recently that Canadian Roots of World Relief was the second largest relief agency that got there fastest, and I think Development and Peace is up there as well. Mm-hmm. So, in sense of the charity part, that's sort of easy for churches to do. And they're effective, and they do it well. And in fact, it reinforces some of the status quo. But as you implied, in order to move, you have to have two steps.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, in all due respect, I've worked for very long with Carlos and Tembe's and Development Peace. I understand the strong messages that are given there and hope. But in reality, as many, many times that we've done those teachings, there's always been a minority of people hearing that. So, as much as it's a prophetic voice and it's exciting to hear, in the parishes, it's not the main gospel that's spoken or enacted. Children learn what they live. It's very hard to get people to actually embrace it. And so, the advocacy part, in theory, is there, but in practice, it's very much like the rich man turns away and says, if that's what it has to be, sorry, I'm not going to do it. Yeah. Although, I will finish this by saying, my Catholic friends right now say,
finally we have a pope we can be proud of. But he is apparently, and I haven't been following the details, but for some of the stuff that he's been poking at, specifically on economic issues, he's getting a huge backlash. So it's kind of like getting back to, you know, children learning what to live. Perhaps the skeptics would be much more willing to embrace these if they would see some of the wealth that is in the Vatican actually not being in the stock market or invested in just kind of structures and creating new structures.
The wealth of the Catholic Church can be known, I think, if you go to a parish and watch them struggle to keep things alive. Are you viable economically, spiritually, you know, all of those resources? Go from parish to parish to parish. And I think the action happens there. I don't know what else we got, you know, except to have a vision of who it is that we are and then continually trying to step into it. Otherwise, we just get washed away by the values of
the church. I guess the question is, because there have been times of shock or prophets, like the Catholic social worker with Dorothy Day or Oscar Romero.
Yeah.
Perhaps this current pope will be like that. But in order to enact these wonderful visions, you really need people who are willing to risk within the institution to practice what they preach within the institution.
Yeah. And you won't hear too many homilies, we call them, about social justice in the church.
The remnant in the church. Yeah, the remnant, not the majority.
Yeah. And that's unfortunate. A priest friend, and he said, I was a pastor in Swift Current, and I taught social justice, social justice, social justice. It was always there. He said there was another church in Swift Current, and he was a charismatic. He said, what we did is we succeeded in dividing the city into social justice people and those who went for, I suppose you'd call it, the gospel of prosperity, you know. And who likes the cross? And yet the cross, we say, is about getting closer. It's a more intimate connection with Jesus who carried the cross. You know. Who likes that? If you have a more pleasing message, you might go for that. And
can I just push this a little bit? Is part of what's behind this a kind of a sense that the Vatican, not the Catholic Church, the Vatican, is a wealthy institution?
Well, from an economic point of view, it is.
Pardon me?
From an economic, if you use the economic analysis, you know, the financial papers.
How wealthy is it?
Queen Elizabeth is the richest woman. I don't track those things,
They're
way up there.
So would those values, like be in art and those kind of things, would those be evaluated and
of course,
be part of it?
It's all part of it.
So then comes the question of who best preserves these treasures that were handed and all of that. And so there are those kinds of questions that also belong to that.
You really think those things should be sold to Bill Gates?
Well, but
would that be useful?
I guess this is my point, is there has to be distinction between, that's right, there's a multiplicity of what we call that, right? You're talking about the state, but you're also talking about treasures.
Yeah.
Traditions and history.
Right.
And so perhaps there would be some symbolic gesture there. You take something that's a priceless masterpiece and say, hey, we're going to do it. We're going to sell this to create a social enterprise or support a research into climate change, something that would be so radical in the economic, in some ways, this is an institution that has the capability to do that, I guess is what my challenge would be. And there's small things that certainly, and I think truly the real hope we have is in individuals gathering in small communities of like Doris Day. I mean, that sort of to me is Dorothy Day, sorry. She was good too.
They were on the other side of the track.
Yes, that's correct.
But there's always this dichotomy, right? When you call yourself whatever you are, Muslim or whatever, there's the institutional stereotype, and there's also the vernacular of living as Jesus did, or living as Buddha, or living as... And that's going to be... That tension is going to be there. But I guess I would challenge then the very people who are in within that institution or in that faith, then have to push back to the institution and say, and challenge them.
And I think Francis is doing that. He says, you know, and Francis of Assisi was that person that transformed the medieval church, and I think that's why this guy chose Francis. He says, we have to be transformed. Like Francis.
Just a kind of parallel case to make this a little more difficult for you, my friend. Detroit has a wonderful art gallery.
Mm-hmm, I heard.
And has built it over a long period of time. Over a long period of time, the municipality of Detroit, using public money, has built a wonderful institution, which now it devolves and sells to private enterprise. Do you really prefer that?
No.
Well, then why would you ask it of the Vatican?
And that was
because the Vatican's the same. The Vatican is also, on this level, a public institution. It's the City di Vaticano. It's a public kind of institution. So I wonder if we don't need to look at what really do we mean by wealth in the Vatican. And I don't know the answer to this, but I think there is... You know, there are people who are land rich and money poor. And when you are an institution that is ancient, you carry an enormous body of material for which you also are a steward in some way. So I'm not trying to justify them. Far be it from me to be an apologist for the Catholic Church. But I think it is a somewhat complex sort of question.
Oh, yes, and I would, to answer back to that, like, I think that public trust of Detroit was exactly the wrong thing. That is a public trust, so it's a betrayal to sell it to private enterprise, just as in some ways it would be for the Vatican to sell off things. But my point being, though, there has to be some other, insert maybe a third alternative, right, that the Detroit pushes back and says, no, we're going to guard this. This is our public interest. Let's push back and say, where is the support for the Commonwealth and the proper support through taxation? Then it could be with the Vatican. Okay,
sure.
How are we going to create new economic systems where we are more just and not having to support our wealth through the current status, right? And that's sort of like the Grameen Bank did. Like there's, you know, and I guess my point is often where that comes from is from the people's movements.
Yeah.
And what would be wonderful, and there are occasionally, there's great philanthropists that do this. I mean, the fact that we even had public libraries come from...
Carnegie.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess this is where...
Thank God for robbery.
Yeah. Or the Nobel Peace Prize coming from... You know.
Dynamite.
Can I just say one small thing here? Because I don't think administratively they're talking about downloading something. But here it is. Now you guys, because it's your life and your gift, you put it into place. And it has to come from underneath. Is basically, I think, the spirit of what it is.
Yeah, but I'm also saying it's not just the little guy that needs to come with the spirit. You know, some of you guys.
Good point.
Not my fault.
And I guess that's what we see where my Catholic friends are saying. They can feel like their pride and hope because this Pope seems to be wrestling with that.
Yeah.
But he's getting a backlash from the institution. Right?
My personal statement is that you can't have a Francis without a Benedict. Because he says you have to go to a depth to mobilize at the level of the heart. And if you don't go deep enough, then you're not going to mobilize at the level of the heart. And so then you do need profound teachings, I think, that pertain to the meaning of the human person, origin, life here, and eternity. And say that eternity is not a postscript on our life, it's the main event all the way through our life. So we need that a kind of teaching. But now is the time, I think, in the church where you can have a Francis and say, okay, now get out, make a mess, go to the marginalized, and be the servant. That's his message.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays itself out. You and then Phil.
I think we've been talking a lot about what has happened in the past with the Catholic Church. Yeah. And I'm an adherent to the Christian faith, and I find like the church has done a lot of really silly things. And that's what people obviously focus on and say, well, what about this and what about this, and we're not doing this right. And the point of this conversation was what Benedict brings us is a proposition for change. And we're focusing instead on the negatives of the past, opposed to the potential that it has.
Yeah.
Yes, there has been money that is spent in a bad way. Yes, there has been people who stay in the church and don't go up. But that is not the point of what Benedict is saying. He's saying there are things that can be changing. We have Christ as an example, to be selfless and to be those things to people, and that's the point. You had started off a while ago, and I don't know if anyone answered, if this seems utopian to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I would answer, of course it does, because of course every proposition for a new society is going to sound mm-hmm. utopian, because who's going to make a proposition for a new society mm-hmm. that's flawed?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So yes, it sounds utopian, but the point is that we have a goal to work towards. So I think we've been focusing a lot on the issues of the Catholic Church, on the issues in society, and that has been a large portion of this course too, and we need to recognize that there has been issues and there are things that need to be changed. And from that, have an idealistic, maybe completely unattainable, because along with being people who are built to give, we're also fallen people. So
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
Yeah, the church has made mistakes. The church is made of fallen people. The world has a lot of great ideas, and people mess them up because we're fallen people. And I think having a utopian thing, or having Christ as our model, who was perfect, we're going to mess it up.
Yeah.
But the point is, what change can we make at this point? And that, I think, is what we're suggesting. So I just wanted to bring
Can I just stitch
that.
One more thing into
yeah.
all the good stuff you're saying, is that he would say that we try to eliminate evil on our own. And then he goes straight to the need then for this word made flesh to transform our lives from within. That when you can make a profession of faith, is what he says, then you feel this fellowship and you feel a new energy, a new opportunity then to try again. I go to confession periodically. And
you should
Catholic,
be going more often.
in Catholic thinking.
From what I've seen,
in Catholic thinking,
your behavior
this
over the last 3 days.
This is what you do. Your conscience gets to speak at its most profound level. And you go in there saying, this is it. And you're transparent to the nth degree. And it's a wonderful moment when you have someone listening to all of that. And then basically say, I forgive you your sins in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit and so forth. And then the next day, and you can't program this. The next day you feel a newness and another opportunity to try again. And that is the great, like the new creation spoken about happens. For me,
the resurrection happens in every person's life.
I'm not saying it doesn't
yeah.
outside
yeah.
it, but
yeah.
I'm saying that so that links up with that whole question of Benedict would say ignorance of our wounded nature with its inclination to evil gives rise to serious problems, and then he goes through it in morality, in education, in politics, and in social action. That's a dangerous one, social action. And he says, now in our economy, we have abused the process in most destructive ways. So that whole thing about what you've said is very crucial.
Do you want to add more to that?
Yeah, I just feel like we've been dwelling so much
yeah.
on what is
yeah.
wrong, which like...
Yeah.
Like the Days of Destruction book, we were talking before everyone came in about the books that we've been reading.
Yeah.
Days of Destruction was everything that's wrong in society.
Yeah.
It was super pressing.
Yeah.
And like I said...
Benedict's not doing that.
No. Hope and
yeah.
joy.
He's
it's got to be hope and joy that are the wings.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
so like, to ignore that purpose because of things that we mess up on is
And that's right on.
Good. Phil?
My question is actually somewhat similar to what was just said. And what about original sin when listening to your conscience?
Yeah.
And how do you know you're not hearing the devil?
And so then you need some external forum. And that is fundamentally, if you go to the teachings and all that kind of thing, it's supposed to create then a view of who the human person is and our need that we can't save ourselves. There is that fallen nature, what he said then is ignorance of our wounded nature. That's a fallen sin. So then what do you do with the wounded nature? And you have to go to the one who can deal with the human, with the wounded nature. And therefore, getting that new opportunity where you now get into the self-gifting. Instead of that self-chastisement, the guilt, the fear, all of that, if that drives the show, it ain't there. So how do you then deal with that aspect of ourself and then be brought to that place where hope and joy, in fact, is what you're giving, you know?
And this is Nietzsche you're talking to here, so. And straight Luther, too. Where did Nietzsche get it from?
He comes right in there with the original sin. That's the big,
I have a kind of confessional obligation here. The doctrine of original sin is not universally held in the church. It is a Latin tradition. Not only is it a Latin tradition, it was articulated so brilliantly by Augustine, who was such a great rhetor, until the last thing he wrote 3 months before he died, in which he said, I think I have given too much to the devil and not enough to the grace of God. So there is two quite different traditions around this, but both of them recognize that the human struggle is enormous, and the struggle for wholeness is enormous. In the Christian East, we speak of the conscience as a prophet in the heart of every human being, which speaks to you about whether what you have done is life-giving or whether what you've done is death-dealing.
Yeah.
Whether it builds relationship or whether it creates estrangement. And that's not, you know, I think for the vast majority of human beings, that is fairly apparent until you sin against it over and over and over again and find yourself lost around that.
See, Paul addresses that too, doesn't he, in Romans 8. You know, I do...
What I would, I do not. What I do, I would not.
So he's talking about that struggle and where what it is that we want to do, we end up not doing. What it is we don't want to do, we end up doing. So then how do you deal with that? And that then comes back to the spiritual question, is where can I, and then Paul answers it, praise to you, Lord Jesus Christ. You know? So he recognizes the power in that offering, you know, as a solution.
Do you want to push farther with that, Phil?
No, because I basically like the vision. It was like a spiritual state of anarchy, where it all comes from the ground up, so to speak. It's a spiritual populism. And it's not being opposed by the church.
That's right.
It actually gives rise to the life of the church.
That's a great line. Yeah. It's spiritual populism. Pope Benedict as a spiritual populist. My God. What an idea. Articulated by Phil Merlin.
Copyrighted.
I will quote you. Benedict, in his little monastery there in Gustavo Gandolfo or wherever he is these days, will have had just a moment of joy. Anything else you'd like to pick up on? Please.
Just a comment drawing on Kate's point that, yes, it is utopian that this idea of an economy based on fraternity, reciprocity, and solidarity. However, it is so close to our human nature, as you said, that it is frightening how utopian it is based on how close it is to us, because I'm pretty sure that it's familiar, and it is those concepts of, again, fraternity, reciprocity, and solidarity are within everybody, every one of us. And it just shows how maladaptive to our human nature the current economic system is, because it completely deviates from the good and services that are produced in Main Street to the phantom wealth that we have nowadays. So the fact that concepts that are so familiar and within everybody of us since we're born are seen as an utopia. So I'm pretty sure that says a lot about our current economic system.
Yeah. Anything else you want to put on the table, or should we wrap it up?
I should speak.
Yeah, I'll do that in a minute. Yeah.
Just,
is there anything else first, and then Bert wants to just tell you a little bit about the handoff. Good.
Okay, you're welcome to keep this if you value it. If not, then just return it. And just to point, the other stuff is self-evident, a couple of things here. This chart, I think, is pretty good. There's a summary. There's a name of the various documents from which this summary comes from. When a document is written, it doesn't give you the whole corpus. Actually, in 2004, John Paul, wishing to resolve that difficulty, had this commission, the compendium, which is kind of an omnibus of all of the teachings, so that it has a beginning, a movement to it, and I suppose you'd say a culmination of it. So,
and every Catholic has memorized it.
That's right.
That's the other really
I could
nice
well be the only one that has read this in our diocese, I'm not sure. But so what you have here is kind of a snapshot. On the back side, it's a little bit about the origin of the document itself, when it was written. So, for instance, an encyclical doesn't just arise out of nothing. So, for example, Pacem in Terris, 1963. The world events at that time was the Cuban crisis, you know, and also
the world.
Yeah, and the erection of the Berlin Wall. So, in Pacem in Terris, or Peace for the World, John the 23rd said, we need to have a document that explores the meaning of what peace really is. Where does it come from? And so forth. So there are about 15 or 16 core documents that, starting with 1891, Rerum Novarum. And it isn't that the church never had social teachings before, it's just that it started crystallizing these in view of where society was. So the first one, Rerum Novarum, was about the Industrial Revolution and the exploitation of the workers and so forth. So there's that.
You've actually done the research here for all the students for their final paper.
I like this one. It took me 9 months to make a... what this is, I have about a 9x5 chart in little strips, each one of which has something on a particular encyclical. And I tried to have this as kind of a summary, and these are the great themes that come out of there, and then as homework to those that was handed out, they're supposed to find out which themes were emphasized in which documents. Now, over on the side here...
And if you got it wrong, you went to hell.
And on the side here is an explanation of those themes. And I thought that this whole thing about bullying, the unspoken truth about bullying, was a nice fit in there, because fundamentally that's what we're talking about. So there's that piece there that you might find interesting. And just kind of quickly, there are other things here that I can't get into. If you're interested in looking at them, reading, that sort of thing, you can keep it. I like this one here as a start out, because basically it's saying that Jesus finds us in the bramble bush or wherever it is, and he comes to take us out. And then on the second level, the church is Jesus is supposed to be the church that looks at the context of society in which we are, and then try to move humanity out of that. That's what that's all about. And you'll see various things in there. So you're really welcome.
Thank you so much, Bert.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.